Now, let's talk to my studio guests, because I'm interested in what exactly happened in Derry at the time of the Easter Rising. How did people react to those momentous events in Dublin? And how much of the news even reached them in this part of the world or in the County Tyrone? Those questions and others will be explored in a new exhibition at the Tower Museum called the 1916 Untold Stories Exhibition. Well, joining me in studio is a remarkable woman, Breedsnee Doherty. Her father, Joseph, had been put in charge of events here in the city by the leaders of the Rising. She's accompanied by historian Brian Lacey, formerly the head of Derry's Museums Service. And good afternoon to you both. Breeds, it's lovely to have you here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Lovely to have you. We spent a little bit of time this morning. Brian, you'll understand if I spend most of my time talking to this remarkable lady. But firstly, could I just ask you to put her father's life and legacy in a context?
Okay. Breeds' grandfather was a man called Michael Doherty, who ran a butcher business and a taxi business, horse and cart taxi business in Derry. Came into Derry from Inishowen in about 1900, or maybe a little bit before that, and was married to a woman called Rose. And they lived in 23 Craigan Street, directly opposite the entrance to the cathedral, St. Eugene's Cathedral. And they had a large family, 9 children. And Breege's father was the third youngest of those children. He was Joseph Doherty. They were a really talented family artist. They're all artists and painters and musicians and all sorts of things. But they were strongly involved in the nationalist movement at the beginning of the 20th century, both on the cultural scene, the Irish language, and particularly on the politics. And they were members of various organisations at the time. But of importance was that Joseph, who was Breege's father, was a member of the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which was a secret organisation. And they were the people who secretly, and there was, you know, secrets within secrets within secrets, they planned the Easter Rising. And Joseph was a member here in Derry, but he didn't know, because it was the Easter Rising was a secret, and he didn't know it was going to happen. And he went to Dublin the week, just a few days before Easter 1916, to see his girlfriend, Margaret Irvine, who eventually became Breege's mother.
A Fermanagh Presbyterian, Brian.
She was from a Presbyterian background, from Irvine of Irvinestown, and originally would have been Scottish planters, Presbyterians. Yeah. I think Margaret by that stage was actually a Catholic, or became a Catholic. Originally her family would have been strongly Presbyterian, of course.
Breege, thank you firstly for coming in, because you had planned an afternoon in Donegal and you gave it up to come in for a chat. I'm delighted you're here. Tell me firstly your earliest memories of your mother and father.
Well, do you know, my earliest memories of my mother and father is their absence. Because, following on what Brian was just saying there, my mother was appointed medical director of Derry after she finished in Dublin University, which was a very big thing. She was only in her 20s. And she lived in Thornden Street and had a place to herself, which was great. But at the end of the war and all during the troubles there, Daddy was mixed up in various raids and, pogroms and stuff. But at the end, when the final Stormont government was set up and the government of Ireland that had newly been elected after the treaty began to take action in 1922, in the autumn of 1922, she was asked to take the oath of allegiance, and she didn't. That she wouldn't take it anyway, because
to the king.
Yes. And it would have been a funny thing for her to do in her eyes at that point anyway. So she wasn't there. And Dad had been sent to America on a mission, or was going to be sent, to explain the anti-treaty stand. And so she stood down. I don't think she was expelled.
As the medical director of Derry?
Yes.
Which was a position of huge standing.
Absolutely, which was wonderful for her. You know? But she stood down anyway. I think she had to stand down. I mean, some people say she was expelled, you know, but she wasn't.
Breech, did she agree with your dad? Was she a Presbyterian Republican, or what did she tell you?
Oh, so Mammy was a very very quiet, modest, well, she wouldn't talk a lot about herself.
Yes.
So you have to ask her questions, really. Not at all. Those Presbyterians had been Catholic up the line. But actually, they had changed and then changed back again. Her grandmother was a Spears, as far as I remember.
Yes.
And I forget now what you asked me.
Oh, it's just about your mother. I mean, it's a remarkable story, but, you know...
Oh, yes, because she went up to Dublin then in 1906 from St. Louis Convent, Monaghan, and run up for the convent because she was able to do arts there, and she had four languages, and among them were Irish, English, French and Latin. And do you know who taught her English? MacDonagh.
Sean.
And Douglas Hyde was the...
First president.
A professor of Irish at the time there.
Yes.
So that was that bit of it. So she had her own entrance into that. It was also in Colossa de Gaeilge up in Gortakirke in Donegal.
Yes.
In the same school or time as Roger Casement. And in fact, there exists a photograph where she and her brother and sister are there in the same photograph as Plunkett that was killed... That was one of the 16, you know.
Breach, you were born in Clarendon Street.
Yeah.
I wonder who stole your Derry accent.
Oh, sure, I got it back when I come back here.
you were born in Clarendon Street. You were born upstairs.
I was born, yes.
And a remarkable story in terms of what was going on upstairs and downstairs. Tell us about that.
Well, this is a story that's in the military notes. I forget who wrote it, but it was a record anyway. He, just tongue-in-cheek, he told this bit of it, that my father was recruiting young men to be in his army and marshalling them up and down and telling them the tactics and stuff. And I think they were a little bit sceptical about him anyway, you know, because he had been a teacher. They didn't like that at all because he had too much methodology. But there was a knock at the door anyway, and a nurse came in with a shawl and a baby. And Daddy took the baby and walked around. And the writer says, this was his firstborn, and I'm the firstborn. But he handed me round to all the men that were there for their benediction, I suppose. Oh, that's the whole story.
Brian, passed round... the top table of the IRA, like a rugby ball.
I mean, it may not be the most politic thing to say now, but Breach must be probably the only baby in the world that was ever born with an IRA honour guard. She was born in the upstairs in the house at 65 Clarendon Street.
And excuse me, I was only saying it was upstairs because afterwards he was able to escape when they wanted to arrest him because he was up in the third story, you know, the third story.
Yes.
Up, and then the first story was where the ordinary citizens were, and there was a place downstairs. That's just
sorry, Brian, work away, yes?
No, I was just going to say, so Breach is born upstairs, and as soon as she's born, she's wrapped in a shawl, and she's brought down to be shown to her father, who at that time was training the IRA, the then IRA. And the newborn baby is passed around the members of the IRA. So that was certainly an interesting arrival in the world and here in Derry. And the date, just to underline, the date was the 14th of June, 1919.
Incredible. Breach, it seems like a different world maybe to modern listeners or modern people like myself. I'm looking at him here, an old black and white image of your father. He had a twinkle in his eye. How do you remember him?
Really, my biggest memory of Daddy, he was, first of all, he was a very rounded man, you know. He was a good singer and a good entertainer and a good speaker and great company, and he had very strong views. But my central conviction about him was that he was a man of absolute integrity and that he had a formidable memory. I've discovered that. People have often said, anyway, in listening to him recalling events beforehand, that they said, yes, why don't you write that? Like, he would sort of put other people right and they would accept it. But I remember him when we finally got together when I was six. Mammy had set us with my grandparents in McGuire's Bridge, and finally when he came home from that mission, 1924, in 1925 we were in Clondalkin, and I was brought up for that period, really. The place was buzzing with memories of what had happened, and old men connected with it used to be in, people that were in Ballykindler with them, and people that had been in Derry with them. I remember, like, Ned McDermott and Dealey McBay and all those, even though I was only six, and we were in the middle of it. Some of the memories were happy and so on, you know.
But Bridget, it must have been a stressful time, because as we say in the modern sense, he was lifted. So your family was, you know, would have had no father. He was incarcerated in England, latterly in Wales. Those must have been difficult times for your mum.
Well, I honestly think that's a very good question. I think my mother was simply marvellous. She was behind Daddy the whole time. But she was of the same convictions, actually. But she knew the rising was happening, actually. Because there's something, there's also in the Chronicles written by Gavin Duffy's daughter, what's her name?
Louise.
Yes, Louise. She remembered going there in Easter week, Holy Week, I mean. And she called into this house where Mammy had lodgings, which was a Republican house. Also in it was the sister-in-law of, one of the men that died. I'll tell you again, one of the 16, Colbert. Yes. And she called in anyway, and Mam said, something's going to happen. And that was Easter week, and Louise said she heard nothing about it, and that Cormac and Mon knew nothing about it. And that was just the week that Daddy had come up to Derry, mm-hmm. and or to Dublin, and that he had been sent back by McDiarmid.
But tell me, Breed, where did you end up? You showed early academic prowess, didn't you? So was academia your first choice as a young woman, or did you know that the convent was for you as a young woman?
Oh, well, glad you mentioned the convent, because really I was nearly 50 years in a convent. I wasn't an academic at all. No, I didn't show any signs of being extraordinarily clever or anything like that.
But hold on, you have a doctorate from the Sorbonne in Paris.
Well, that was later. But during that time, no, Fiona was supposed to be clever. I really was an outdoor girl. I just loved being outside. But I loved learning. Somebody said I should be called Why. And this man has a shanuckle. Let me say the words. What is it?
Tussock Olus in cover.
Which is, Bran?
Yes. The beginning of knowledge is inquiry.
So Breed's nickname was Why?
Well, anyway, just to answer your question, I don't know. I think I was inspired by the Irish stories of the Irish monks, and also by the stories of those men at the Rising, that if they believed in something and that it was worthwhile doing, you just didn't count the cost. You went for the total picture.
But didn't a free spirit like yours find itself confined by organised religion and the convent, Breach? Suddenly here's this young sprite who loves the outdoors, who still finds herself swimming in salt water off Sleeve League in her 90s. Surely that spirit is confined by organised religion.
Well, first of all, I was at school in St. Louis, Monaghan. And from the first minute I stepped into it, I was happy. It was absolutely full of music. It was doing theatre work, and every bit of it was centred. It was a Class A school, did all subjects through Irish, and it was steeped in that culture very beautifully. Now, remember, they were also of French origin, so they were very good at teaching languages and so on. And the motto was Dieu le veut, God wills it. But on the other hand, we had, do you know that little Irish shanachle, courage in our hands, truth in our hearts, and, you know, strength in our arms.
Yes.
Yart the rare or meher, and keep your word. Bart the rare or meher.
Your life, and I've only met you today, Breed, speaks to me of a very old association between Irish people and French people. There's always been, you know, the battles between the kings, when very often the Gael finds a kindred spirit in France. Have you felt that? Because it certainly, you were attracted to Paris, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. But my mother was good at French, very good. She was a speaker. And I was in France in 1935 before I ever entered. I spent 6 weeks away over in La Baule with her. And we had little words in school and back at home. Cela va sans dire. Or calling little gadgets were all French words. And faire la toilette and have a soiree with somebody and so on. So that was there. But the whole background was the very same as I had had in my... Oh, by the way, I grew up in the 30s. And I think there was a terrible slump for the ones, especially that had been anti-treaty in the 20s.
But you see, this is where your father's life is interesting. And I could talk to you all day about your life. Your father, I sense, Breege, was torn with the Home Rule and the treaty because he was voted in with a huge majority in North Donegal, declined to go to Westminster, but took his seat in the first Dáil Éireann. Does he strike you as a man who was torn? He strikes me as a man who didn't like physical, human, militaristic conflict. Would that be true?
Well, I think that is really true.
He wanted to get on with people, North and South, didn't he?
But the same thing... You see, I can't imagine. I don't think he took any part at all in the Civil War. I'm only looking back myself because I remember the time of the Civil War. But no, it wouldn't be true to say that he wasn't for the military because, you see, I think that the people that were the instigators, let's call them, of the rising were three distinct bunches. The Connolly section, which was really socialist, yeah. Basically. The IRB, which was really military to get the truth, justice back for Ireland.
And the Dreamers.
And then the intellectual ones,
poets.
You know. And they were motivated by something that was right and beautiful. And, you know, they do, because after all, truth is beautiful. And the people that stand for it are. And if the price is, I think they were so disappointed about Home Rule, the whole story of Parnell, the Land League, you know, everything that had gone before, that they had to strike, especially when the volunteers got their arms and set up an army.
Brian, let me just bring you in at this aspect. How do you read Breege's father's contribution at that stage? It was a very interesting time. Here's a guy, he was elected to North Donegal with a majority against the establishment of 5,000-6,000. This is a remarkable person.
Yeah. Well, as a younger man, of course, he's elected in 1918 at the end of the First World War. But earlier, back in about 1914, 1915, he had been involved in there's a marvellous story in one of his letters about him getting arms collected from Edmiston Keys, the shop in Shipkey Street. And these were arms actually for the UBF, for the Loyalists, if you like, at the time. And they're sort of siphoned off to the Republicans. And indeed, I often wondered about whether the story was true or not. And yet I checked with the National Museum in Dublin and they actually have a lot of UVF guns that were found in Dublin during the Rising, you know. So that story seems to be correct. And he was ready. He went to Dublin just before Easter to meet his girlfriend. But he knew Sean McDermott, one of the guys, and McDermott sends him back to Derry and says, go back to Derry. And he didn't want to go to Derry. He wanted to stay in Dublin. But he's told to go back to Derry to be ready, as it were, for the outbreak of the Rising in Derry.
And he did that under oath, basically.
Oh, we
have something to tell you. You have to get it to Derry, and then you have to ensure that it gets to Tyrone.
On the day that he was given these orders, he was taken into a back room and he was sworn the IRB secret oath of allegiance. You know, in fact, he had, as Breege says, he had actually taken that oath twice. But he's told, this is a huge secret, although it's beginning to seep out. But he's told that at Sunday, on Easter Sunday at 6 o'clock, there's going to be the uprising. And he's sent back to Derry to get ready for it. And they're all waiting in Derry. And, you know, the amazing thing about communications nowadays, I mean, you know, not the mobile, all the rest of it, they didn't have phones, they didn't have newspapers, you know, except occasionally all that. But they did have other things. For instance, there were trains directly to Dublin 3 or 4 times a day. And on the post was remarkable. On Easter Sunday morning, at 9 o'clock, there was a delivery of a post in Derry. Imagine on an Easter Sunday morning. And that brought little more bits of news to them about what to do. But basically, the orders never came. There was what was called the countermand when the Owen McNeill, the leader of the volunteers, who learned at the very late stage that the rising was going to happen and decides to cancel it, basically to cancel it. And Owen McNeill later becomes the... In fact, he's elected the Member of Parliament for the city here, for Derry, in 1918. But so what I'm really trying to say is that Joseph would have had some involvement in the military planning of the rising, but then that didn't happen.
He was seconded back to Derry.
He was, yeah. And just one other thing, because he belonged to a large family, and Seamus's brother was also very active, and Seamus was one of the people who actually very strongly tried to move the argument on away from the violence to, if you like, politics. And he's remembered for that in Dublin tradition, although he was originally... So, but and I think, like a lot of the people at the time, when the Anglo-Irish Treaty is arrived at in 1921, and it means the partition of Ireland into the north and the south, a lot of people, if you like, their hearts were broken, quite apart from their political, you know, feelings. This was a huge... They almost couldn't believe this was such a shock to the system. And they were, you know, they were very, what's the word, split in their... psychologically split between whether they should continue the war or they should accept the treaty. And that, of course, led to the Civil War in the South.
Breach, tell me how you reflect. At 96 years old, as I say, still swimming in the last couple of years in the open ocean off the back of a boat, I mean, this foot of sleeve league, beggar's belief. I mean, how do you reflect now on your father's contribution to the century?
I think that he was one of those people that are classified today, like with Pearse and everybody else, as romantic. He loved that all that poetry that had been written, but he loved what it inspired and truth. I think that my father was absolutely stand for two words he often uses, truth and justice. And I think he was absolutely committed to getting that for the Irish people. And I also think he was very proud of his name, O'Doherty. The banner, the motto of it is Ornuchas, which is our heritage. And for example, he loved Derry. And Derry is Didichol an Cille. And Derry is, therefore, it has two cathedrals of two different sides, at two colleges with the name Columba. And what are they honouring? They're honouring really a man devoted to knowledge and the truth and justice of what we are in this existence.
But it begs the question, Breach, and I would never place you in the modern, the politic of what has become in latter-day Ireland, but what are your reflections on the other? With a Presbyterian mother who journeyed remarkably in her own right, with a proud Irish Republican father, what are you left to reflect upon when it comes to the other, the Unionist, the Northern situation? Have you come to any conclusions on that?
Well, I was trying to think out if there could be any sort of conclusion to that. There were two offers for rule in Ireland. One had been already experimented, the Parliament, when they had it in Dublin. But that was really only for a section of the community, the Protestant. I mean, if you were a Catholic, it didn't apply. And they benefited, and the rest of the country didn't. And then there was next home rule was promised. And I think at the head of Daddy and people like that, that that would be simply like an English local government. And that means that people, you know, they wouldn't be ruling themselves, really. They'd be ruling for elsewhere. And I think that you could see Stormont as such a thing, that they weren't really for them, that they're actually really for somebody else, so that independence wouldn't be really achieved unless they had the sovereignty of the whole. And I think that my father also thought that since he got that majority on the way that he had been canvassing, that he knew the people at this point in the treaty debate would go for it under duress, but they'd hate it. And he said, I can't believe that there was persuaded that it was its right to lose it. You know, but you asked me about what he thought of the unionists. He was always friendly with people. I mean, I know when he went over to Canada, he was singing the same songs as the Orange Men.
And by the way, he couldn't have got that huge majority in North Donegal without the Ulster Presbyterians. It seems the Presbyterians loved him as
but
well.
But no, not really. No. That he wasn't a Presbyterian.
No, not at all. But he was shored up in the vote brand. Fair to say that he probably couldn't have got that.
Well, he picked a Presbyterian. He'd be the daughter of a Presbyterian. But I just think, I don't know what to say. It's very hard to say.
Let me ask you this way, if I can, Breeze. As an O'Doherty of the... I can't help but think you're an O'Doherty of the old Gaelic time. A family of academics, broadly read, travelled, ambassadors hand over fist down the family. Does that notion of the old Gael or the old Gaelic identity, do you feel that you fit into the modern world?
Well, I tell you, I think that that our history is not known to most of the people in Ireland. The real history of that we did have a culture, and the discovery of that culture, I forgot this, was made now by a group of people, those young men with like Pierce, that had the English language perfectly and loved it, that were able to think that we have our own language. But it's not only a language, it's carrying the thoughts of our people for years, and those thoughts are beautiful because they were Irish speakers. And I know that myself, because doing the poetry through the ages, looking at the Celtic studies that was done, looking at travelling around Europe to see where the monks were, where they're greatly revealed, that was our real Ireland. The Irish have a total commitment to knowledge and what knowledge brings.
And yet that romanticism that many would observe in the proclamation about, you know, the equality of men and women, well, you can't say that's been delivered on the island, Breed. I wonder, what are your thoughts on the Ireland of the future, the Ireland that you will hand down to those who come after you? Are you encouraged by the look and the shape of it?
No. I am. I know enough that has good things have happened for Ireland. But I do think there's a terrible division in Ireland socially yet, and that some people have not got their justice, and that there is that kind of snobbish difference between one side and the other, and that the old Gaels, this might be my idea, the people that have kept a kind of a silver line of constancy to a language and a thing, not belligerently, but because they were bewailing the loss of the land or because so-and-so, that they kept that they are there. But they happen to turn out to be the rather poorer stock now that were deprived of their lands. And, you know, the other people that benefited from new jobs and everything didn't. But now you have a group of people that are as good culturally like as the others and have assessed that this is worthwhile and that they... I have to say the faith that they inherited for most of them was definitely worthwhile because it's based on the worth of the individual for everybody, for brotherhood. So I think that education has become a crammy system. And I'm broadly, I shouldn't be that broad, because I don't mean that, but the whole point system, it's not for knowledge, for the spreading of our minds, for the accession to who we are as people, individuals, and what is lovely in what we have inherited. And I just think that's a wonderful thing to inherit, and we don't know enough about it, that we nearly kowtow to other cultures. Even today, if you ask somebody, do you speak and learn to Gaelic? I do know, I know a word or two. And he says, you parle français? Un petit peu. I'd be delighted, you know.
Brian, I don't know about you. I know you've been around a few corners with regard to history and legacy. I've rarely met an individual whose life encompasses a century. And well, she just finally, she's a remarkable lady.
Well, there's one story she didn't tell about her father. Sorry, one story about her father. When her father was elected in December 1918, he was here in Derry. He got on a white horse and he's rode out to see his granny. It was just a place called Gorty Arrigan near Buncrana. And she, his granny at that time, was 101 years old. And his granny, of course, was delighted that he... Well, she said, I never thought I'd see the day that my grandson would be an MP. But she also told him that she herself, as a young girl, had walked from Buncrana to Sligo to see Daniel O'Connell. Now, that's in two lives, Breed's life and her great-grandmother's life. That takes us from today back to the time of Napoleon and Wellington and the Battle of Waterloo. You know, in the space of just two lives.
Your company is a pleasure, both of you. Brian, just finally for now, a film and good efforts on the part of the council that you left, and certainly your legacy is alive in terms of innovative means at the heart of the council. Just finally.
Thanks very much.
The film, yeah.
Oh, the exhibition tonight. Sorry, I was
confused.
I thought there was a film as part of it.
There is a film of some interviews with people like Breege and I think some other people who are giving their memoirs and their memories of the event, you know.
It's all courtesy of the Tower Museum. Brian, thank you indeed. Breege, thank
that
you.
That wasn't much good, Mark.
You were great and you're still on air.
Oh, no, it was awful. I'm not a bit pleased.
Oh, you were great. Right, 712-666-522. I think we're going to take another wee track, are we, from Six Strings and Stigma.